Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. I hope you are well wherever you are listening. My guest this week is Victor Stefanopoli, the Chief Operating Officer of Mzansi Sat. Victor is a citizen of the world, having lived in a number of countries over the years. The son of French and German parents, he's lived in Cape Town since 2014. He said he came out here for a month's holiday and never went back. Mzansi Sat is a satellite broadband company that is on a mission to provide stable and affordable satellite broadband to Southern Africa. It's a bold vision. We talk about some of the technical aspects of this project, as well as the potential to impact people's lives across the subcontinent in a number of different ways. Victor also chats about the ease of doing business in South Africa, the importance of investing in one's colleagues, employees, and how satellite broadband can impact education in particular across the region. So please now enjoy my chat with Victor. Victor, thanks for your time this afternoon on a sunny Saturday afternoon in Sandton.
It's a pleasure.
And it's good to meet you. We have obviously been exchanging emails. I did have that panic this morning when I thought our meeting was at 10:30 and it turned out that I was right. I just kind of got up and ran. I was watching the rugby and this thing came up on the thing. I just left my mate's house and said, got to see you later. Here we are.
I might come across as like very cold, but I will never ask people to be around me before 11 a.m. for my own sake. So
no, that's cool. You said you've had a busy week. Have you been traveling this week?
Or? Yes, very busy.
Where have you? What Botswana, have you been up to?
Botswana, Kenya. In order to actually understand why I went to Botswana and Kenya, it's more important to understand that. How long we've been doing at Mzansi Sat what we've been doing.
Well, maybe we can just jump straight into it then. Tell me a little bit about Mzansi Sat then, and what are you hoping to do there?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so Mzansi Sat is a company, and it is also a mission.
Right.
Our mission is to provide affordable, stable satellite broadband to South Africa and the Southern African market. So,
Okay, it's not only South Africa, because that's what I wanted some clarity on. All right. And are you going to do that by launching your own satellite? Is that...
That is the plan.
Yeah.
That is the plan. It's just a project on a time scale a lot of young people and young professionals can't fathom, because 8 years, 9 years, 10 years are crazy amounts of time, especially these days. But it is about much more than just shooting a satellite into orbit and say, great, we have this super expensive infrastructure and it's, you know, really fancy, and yes, it will ease communicating in Southern Africa, South Africa, for the years to come once this happens. But something which is very important for me is that it's not just about the infrastructure and enabling people to communicate. You have to give people tangible examples and case studies how this new technology, how this new infrastructure can impact their lives. So
yeah,
for me, it's not just about infrastructure, and that's a very long process. You go through a lot of administrative hurdles, a lot of regulatory you really need an angel's patience with this, but on the other side, the time you spend waiting for the regulatory body to do what it should do best, which is actually helping companies like ours and stakeholders that want to do change and want to push the envelope forward, you have a lot of time to think and to develop concepts, ideas, interventions on how you can augment that value offering. So for us, it's not just about allowing you to communicate. We also want to give you platform and devices and software and applications to harness that new infrastructure.
Yeah, I suppose, there's so many things now to talk about in terms of a sort of internet providing people with online access and what the purpose or point of that is. And I mean, you talk about case studies. I suppose, you know, it's always, these things are always touted as, you know, they're going to change people's lives in so many ways, be it through education or healthcare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm still not sure that we kind of have seen sort of the tangible benefits at a sort of broad scale of those kinds of things. I mean, people are using, obviously, the accessibility to communicate, but beyond that, it's difficult to see, you know, what, you know, we talk about the digital divide and closing the digital divide and sort of the impact it's going to have, particularly on poor people or rural communities and all these things. But, you know, sometimes I struggle to see the tangible today benefits of that. The other thing is, obviously, broadband satellite seems to be quite a controversial sort of technology in sort of internet provision, if I can put it that way. And particularly your approach seems to be a geostationary as opposed to low Earth orbit solution, which is where sort of Amazon and these other people, SpaceX, you know, some of these big global players are getting into this satellite internet broadband access or whatever technology. But you seem to be going another route, and I just, so that's another thing I'd like to sort of talk to you a little bit about.
Sure, it's a very, very, very valid point. The question really is, we have to be able to walk before we run, and we have to be able to run before we go for a sprint. And Usain Bolt has been sprinting for a very long time. It takes a lot of experience. The tangent I'm trying to make here is that everybody talks, you know, about 5G, the new terrestrial...
Fourth IR.
Yeah, you know, Internet of Things, fully automated machine transactions. I mean, look, we can talk for days about this, you know, like experts around the world are debating the pros and cons of the 5G technology. And everything is about speed these days. But the question is, is it really about speed? Zanzizat has connectivity at the back of its head, right? So we are, the technology we're using is a C and Ku band satellite. That's what we intend to launch into orbit, which is geostationary. The question is, if you have people who have no connectivity in rural areas or can't afford connectivity in more urbanized, you know, less urbanized areas, the first challenge is, can they afford it? Like a lot of these new Ka band or super fast satellite systems, yes, they work. They work a treat, but they cost a lot of money. Mm. Not maybe for the Westerner or for, you know, the ginger resident of Santon, but for the people in the countryside, the disenfranchised communities, the rural communities. So before we even talk about, you know, luxurious things like augmented applications or watching Netflix all day via satellite link, you know, all these things, which is evident for the city dweller. We need to first consider, okay, that there are 40-45% of this country who have no reliable, fast enough internet connection to do the most basic transactions, like, you know, getting...
Just basic, simple, you know, access.
Yeah, basic stuff, like, you know, weather forecasts, emails, market updates, you know, just... enable to
simple experience, a simple online experience that cannot,
yeah, just, you know, not even plug into an experience but plug into data. You know, like for say farmers or co-ops or even the, you know, the very small scale agricultural applications. Education is also a big thing in rural areas. Healthcare, I can talk about that for days. But before we consider going, okay, we need the fastest infrastructure under the Lord in these areas, first we need to create an environment in which this technology can be taken up. People have to learn and understand from scratch how this technology can enrich enrich their daily lives and their daily business transactions. I'm not saying they have no idea, but, you know, your mobile phone, and most people have one, no mobile phone can exceed the capacities in usability that are limited by the network. So that's what we want to do. We want to start with a very basic, the very foundation for a reliable telecoms infrastructure in Africa.
In Southern Africa.
In Southern Africa, but South Africa is our home. So, of course, we're very keen on having South Africa as the champion of our strategy. And also in order to show the other countries, hey, this works. We are not pulling a rabbit out of the cylinder and the top hat, sorry. We're not pulling out a rabbit out of the top hat and saying, Shazam, it's working, and we're not telling you why. Then you mentioned, you know, Facebook, Amazon, OneWeb, these low orbit, low Earth orbit satellites, which are very fast, and you always have one in the sky and you can download. So there's two things. The first one is that need much more energy and more complex infrastructure to run, which costs money, which most African countries don't have. it's a shame, but it's true. So, you know, like our solution very much addresses this. Okay. It has to work. It's got to be down and dirty. That's why we do with CNKU and geostationary, and not a technology where you have to permanently track one or two or three orbital assets around the planet. That's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, there's no such thing like free lunch, and I'm gladly believing that, you know, Facebook or the other guys, you know, want to offer us a satellite-based internet service to everybody in Central Africa and Africa. But nothing's for free. So, you know, what is not the price, but the cost of this service? Why? Why are you so kind to us in Africa to provide a free satellite service? You are not a good Samaritan. Facebook is listed on a stock exchange. They have their shareholders to answer to. So whatever they're doing, there will be a bottom line, and it's going to look very good. I do not know why they pursue their strategy. Right now, it seems like to be a massive, aggressive push for market acquisition. But maybe one day they will start charging. And when we start about money, talk about money in Africa, is African currencies are always weaker than Northern and Western currencies. And the second thing, where Mzanzilat is very big on in terms of accounting, and in terms of financial structuring, is that we do not want to charge our stakeholders, the South African clients, the Southern African clients, in dollars or euros or renminbi, no interest. We want to charge them in the local currency. The two reasons why we do this is, for them, it makes their expenses more forecastable. And with, you know, inflation and erratic foreign exchange rates, if you're unlucky and your financial administration in any given country hasn't done as much of a good job they should have done, after 15 years, you might end up paying twice as much for the service you signed up for 15 years ago, because the inflation has absolutely killed the, you know, the value for money ratio. So that's why we say, okay, no, we want a solution that goes in rands, or, you know, in Kwanzaa, or in Kenyan shilling, whatever. But we need to keep the money. We need to keep the equity inside the country.
Right.
South Africa is a country that needs an equity injection, and not just equity draining to the players on the Arab Peninsula or in Luxembourg or in the United States. The solution very much tries to embrace this whole local is lekker vibe, and we can make it work ourselves, and we don't need the others. It's like the idea to create a regional satellite.
How did you end up in South Africa? You said you originally, your parents are German-French.
Yes.
You grew up in Europe then?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I know you went to university in London.
Yes.
How did you get here?
I mean, short answer, on a plane. A long answer. My mother, actually, 10 years ago, she always wanted to go on a game drive and do this whole safari thing.
All right.
And we were just looking, you know, for the right country to do this safari holiday, where we can look at, you know, elephants and lions and all this. You know, have, you know, this really European safari experience, because we've never done it before. So South Africa experienced for the first time when I was 18 years old. The first 6-7 hours in Cape Town when I landed was like, oh, okay, there's like a, you know, Cape Town, and you drive through the townships in front of Cape Town. Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay, what the heck is this place? And then 2 days later, I was like, okay, you know what? Screw it. These people are cool. Like there's something in the air. People might not have much, or they might not have, you know, what we have in Europe, but they kind of have this approach to life. Don't take yourself too seriously. Work hard. Have fun. That was back in the day when Cape Town was still very chilled out. I mean, Cape Town has gone through a crazy metamorphosis over the last decade. Anyway, so I knew South Africa. I went to holiday 2-3 times a year to this country. I was absolutely hooked on Mzansi. And then after university, I was done with 5 years in Great Britain, in London. You know, I kind of was, okay, am I going to stay here? Am I going to try very hard to chase my dream of becoming, you know, a film producer and, you know, working right. very long hours?
Because that actually that's what you studied, right?
Yeah, I'm a Bachelor of Fine Arts. I'm a classically trained TV and film producer. And, I never worked on a film set for a single day in my life. I always did TV and live TV. I never really ended up on a film set, which I think was a good thing because I'm so punctual. It essentially would have aggravated regular film crews. But after university, I just said, you know, screw it. I need to get out of here. I need a change of scenery. I need a holiday. I planned to stay a month in Cape Town. And before I knew it, it's been 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, that's right.
I just was like, okay, cool. I just went with the flow.
Yeah. It's quite addictive. I don't know, as you say, I mean, I am South African and I've lived outside of South Africa and you come back here and, I mean, it is a crazy place, isn't it? It's got such a sort of devastating and violent history and yet, I don't know, there's something, I mean, the violence is still kind of around, but at the same time, as you say, there's some kind of energy or positivity that's hard to kind of put your finger on.
Yeah, yeah.
Somehow.
There is, you know, there is this saying, suffer, mark, and plan, right? Like, South Africans are, I think you guys are at your A game when you're with your back against the wall. And in this country, I've seen so much creativity, so many good ideas, so many, you know, like, people really want to get shit done here. Like, I mean, there's not many, but those who do, they, you know, they're on fire. They have drive. They want to, you know, get people involved. And being an entrepreneur or being, you know, just like a hustler, it's either you got it or you don't.
Right? Sure.
Like, you can... There's a code of conduct, you know, there's good practice, but essentially you wanting to do things differently, that kind of for you qualifies me as, okay, you don't just have an idea, you want to follow through with it. Problem I think here in South Africa is when it comes to innovation and new companies and new applications is there's really not a very big venture capital and private equity kind of scene here.
People willing to take a risk in a way for the sake of innovation.
Yes, and a lot of money, you know, would also not come from South Africa. And something I have just realized is, you know, very often when I'm in a boardroom and I'm working with people, nobody's mother tongue seems to be English. Like, you know, like we have 11 languages in this country. Everybody is quite proud to have their own language. They speak it at home, and English is just, I think, one of the few things in this country that keep us together, right?
Mm.
But if you're sitting around like a big boardroom table and you're talking about a thing, and you know you already sit around the table, but you know everybody's kind of on the same page, and you want to move it and do it, but then people start talking and they recapitulate and they show their angle on things, is there's a lot of lost in translation. Because different language groups, different ways of, you know, positioning things, framing content.
Ways of just communicating.
Yeah, conveying emotions. So if 90% of the mess or the problems or the, arguments I came across in this country were not because people were not of the same opinion or didn't have the same intentions. They just have very different ways of expressing how they feel, how they want to do things. But essentially on paper, if they were to just write it down, they would be all on the same page, quite literally. So
yeah, I kind of...
For me, it's less about translating... For me, it's less about, you know, translating English to Afrikaans or Xhosa or Zulu. It's more about... how you say, reconciling sentiment.
Mm.
And then just asking very precise questions.
You get
very precise answers, and then you realize, okay, we all got really crazy and panicky for 35 minutes for no good reason. Mm. We just have to, like,
You've spoken in one of the documents, I think, I'm not sure what was your bio or the, an email, when you spoke about sort of going from a sort of greenfield kind of thinking to more a startup kind of thinking. In your thoughts around a startup, you place a lot of emphasis on building a culture, focus on people as opposed to a product.
Yes.
And I just wonder if you could expand a little bit on that. Why? Because it doesn't seem to be a very capitalist idea or even a very sort of South African business idea to focus on people. It seems that, you know, bottom line is everything in most companies.
Yeah.
And I just, how do you sort of reconcile that that approach with wanting to build a business?
Well, I think I'm purely now talking about the startup space. So for me, it's just like, you know, first of all is, if I think you are a good employee or you're a good collaborator, right? First of all, I want to keep you. Secondly, I want you to work for me, right? So there's no point having a deal for me that goes, okay, I'll pay you bottom dollar. You're going to work for the experience or the exposure or, you know, fluffy shit.
Mm.
That's not tangible. Money can't buy experience. So in order to actually get you to experience and get to grow on a professional level, you have to be exposed to a lot of things. And a lot of these things you will be exposed to, you might want to expose yourself out of your free volition. So when I work with people, I push them deliberately towards their borders or towards their limits in the context of discovering new things.
Hmm.
That's the first thing. So currently, we do not have the money to do this, but something which would be absolutely great is if I could, you know, once a year send employees that have great potential on, say, master classes or university short courses to very good universities to just, you know, exchange ideas and get the newest lowdown from the academic side, you know, prove their ideas and concept. Biggie here in this country is health insurance, you know, like... If you do not have to take care of a simple thing like health insurance, for me it's like, great, I need a healthy workforce, and healthy workforce is happy workforce. The psychologic effects of just bad that
security,
health,
yeah,
you know, like if you are not healthy, my company is not healthy, because you feel down, you feel unhappy, you feel sick, you're not productive, you might... If you have the flu, you know, infect other people. So if you are happy and productive and healthy, everybody is. And this is kind of like the lowdown how I apply this concept. And if I say, okay, I want my staff to be educated. I want my staff to explore. I want my staff to develop and enjoy these little successes, accumulating eventually in a big success. I want... my people, I want my company, everybody to feel happy.
Shared experience
and say this is fulfilling, this is not just, you know, turning up at 9 a.m. in the office and you know, doing the work. This is generally a journey, and a lot of, you know, personnel turnover comes because people do a job, they do it for the money, but eventually, you know, you kind of reach this glass ceiling and you go, off, you know, I'm stuck, I need something else, I need to do something else. And question is, in the South African market now specifically, is there an opportunity which allows that specific employee to grow? So me investing in people is investing in my company, because it shapes an identity, it shapes a form. And I've been working with very different people over the last 5 years, and it's been great to... it's not mentorship. I don't take you on the side and go, hey, I want to be your mentor or whatever. It's just like, look, we're all growing up here. We are a startup. When I started on Mzansizat, I had no bloody clue what I was talking about. You know, the first 2 years was very much learning the brass tacks. And then, you know, I said, okay, I need to learn certain things, I need to do certain things, and I went on short courses, and I went to Harvard Business Education, Executive Education, and all these things, and yes, it costs money, yeah. Mm. And in many instances, people say this is ridiculous, but it gives you a perspective, it gives you a Rolodex. Like, if you stay happy and hungry and discovering, this is great.
Curious.
This curiosity drives a startup to become more exciting and more productive and gives it an edge. Mm. So that's why I like to invest in people. People are important.
How have you found, I was noticing, you know, South Africa on the ease of doing business index, whatever it's called, I forget who brings it out. I mean, currently sort of 82 out of 190 from 32 out of 190 in 2008.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure, but you know, there's hundreds of parameters, I suppose, that are used to put that index together. But how have you found, like, dealing with regulation, with the business environment as a startup in South Africa, and somebody who's obviously coming from outside with perhaps a different sort of business milieu, business experience? How's that translated into the South African context?
I think we need to very clearly separate two things here. The first thing is the legislation. The second thing is the execution thereof. I think South African law in many cases is very good, very progressive, and is enabling a fairly streamlined way of doing business. Where it starts getting jerky is being able to follow these laws, and also on an official level, also on an administrative level, decision makers, civil servants, they're dragging their feet.
Hmm.
So we kind of have an infrastructure already that works and that is sensible, but it is just the speed at which these decision-making processes are moving.
The state bureaucracy in this context.
It's not even the bureaucracy. Like it's for me, it's like, you know, you tick. What is bureaucracy? It's essentially a fancy way of saying you have to tick boxes to get the next form to tick more boxes. I can tick the boxes, but you know, if I have to wait, like metaphorically speaking, 3 months until this, you know, ticked box sheet process is being analyzed and processed, that makes business hard.
Hmm.
I think you waste a lot of time waiting for decisions to be made.
Hmm.
And I'm really not alone with that with that point of view. Hmm. I was invited by the by DTPS, the Ministry of Communications, last Saturday to the presidential roundtable for the fourth industrial revolution with a focus on infrastructure. And honestly speaking, is if you would have like, you know, dropped a bomb in this room, like a lot of decision makers and stakeholders in the telecoms industry in South Africa would have been wiped out. It was very good. It was a very good guest list, and literally from the CEO levels of very big public private companies to startups like ours, the overall sentiment was we need faster decision making processes, and that sluggishness makes doing business in Africa, in my opinion, the most painful.
Hmm.
Otherwise, I think South Africa is, besides its cultural quirks on paper, South Africa is a good place to do business because at least you know what you're buying into. Unlike where in some countries in Europe, they say, yeah, doing business is easy and this and that and this and that. And in some countries, you know, you get already slapped with like 5,000, 6,000 euros worth of taxes or fees or expenses or accountant fees. You haven't even made a single euro of revenue yet, and you already pay for the privilege to have your own company.
Hmm.
In South Africa, at least, it's not like that. You know, I go to company's house, cost between 500 and 1,000 rands. I have a PTY Limited, yes, I have to fill out my paperwork, which is good practice, right? But SaaS is going to leave me alone as long as I haven't actually, you know, passed my minimum threshold for being taxable. So in many ways, I think South Africa is a bit more fairer and a bit more direct as to creating businesses than many other countries in the West that purport to be good for business.
I want to just talk a little bit about another thing that you've written about that you've sort of feel strongly about, and I hope I'm not misquoting you, is free healthcare, free internet, and free movement of people.
Yeah.
Do you still hold those views?
Free internet, I think it's internet, water, electricity. I think that's kind of like how a society should run today. Hmm. So,
how do you then sort of square that? You're trying to get into a business of making money from the internet, and what is the business case then in that context?
So essentially speaking, is our context is Mzanzizat is, don't know whether you read that article, it came out like last November, October, where I was like on the photo and said we're promising 1 gigabyte of broadband internet for less than 25 rands. I'm not saying this is the most competitive price for 1 gigabyte of internet, but if you have the choice between 25 rand, 1 gigabyte internet, and none at all, I think we have a pretty good value proposal. A satellite will never be able to replace broadband fiber. It's not what we're there for. Mm. We are there to, on one side, supplement spectrum, and on the other side, to create access to spectrum in areas which have none at all. Like, it is much easier to set up a dish in the middle of, you know, the Northwest or in Limpopo or in KwaZulu-Natal in a remote community than having to dig up the ground and lay fiber for $1 million a kilometer.
Sure.
So we have the infrastructure side, the infrastructure element covered, and say, yeah, if we know we're going to offtake enough data from us per month, per year, yeah, you know what, fucking, we give you the infrastructure to connect. Because again, there's three steps. There's the infrastructure we can offer, then it is connecting people, and then people need to be able to connect. Because despite me being able to beam a signal on the ground, if the people on the ground cannot afford the infrastructure to connect, you know, it's a zero-sum game. So when I say, you know, free internet, it's free access to internet, like ubiquitously available. And yes, of course, some people in the lower income classes, sure, why shouldn't they have access to free internet? Because honestly speaking, is you need to kind of access your more greater community, which is your country, which might be your county. I think a lot of, again, problems arise. That's not an African context, it's a global context. It's because people can't communicate properly. That has on one side to do with what you communicate, but also how you communicate. Mm. So if there's no infrastructure or no means in place to exchange ideas or to exchange information, how can you, you know, expect a country to develop economically? And we try to address this on that side. That's my opinion about free access to internet. I'm not saying free internet. Hmm. Well, I want to be very clear on that, because somewhere somebody needs to make money with this.
Exactly.
Regardless whether this is government subsidized or not, but yes, internet is important. Mm-hmm.
You also spoke about ecosystems, ecosystems, and I just wanted you to maybe expand a little bit on that. Are you saying that a company like Mzanzizat would offer, say, as part of the subscription or however, whatever sort of model you're going to be using, offer certain sort of apps or features for free or part of the package, or are you going to be sort of building your own apps and things like that? Or am I making sense?
You're making sense. We're not in the app development space though. When I am.
But when you say ecosystem, then in this context, what are you talking about?
So when I'm evangelizing about ecosystems, is that, you know, this is like the tech industry is a give and take, right? So it's an example I have brought up way too many times, and if anybody hears it, again, I apologize already. But essentially, what Mzanzizat aims to be is the Trans-Alaska pipeline, right? We are just, our primary job is to transfer bulk amounts of data from A to B, from dish to dish, like via space. That's what we do. But our infrastructure is only as good as the services and the interventions it enables, right? We need South Africans and other Southern Africans to take ownership and to take confidently advantage of that new infrastructure. And on one side, we invite people to talk to us, to work with us on developing satellite optimized services, whether that is healthcare or education, or you know, like freedom of banking. I mean, you know, wherever data moves from A to B, we can help. Like, that's the business we do. So that's one thing. And because we are not in, you know, the business of programming apps or developing code, that's not what we do.
No.
But we will, with the money and the cash flow we create, we will invest in such companies where we think, okay, it makes sense.
To partnerships or...
Yeah. Yeah, through partnerships, through investment, through whatever. But it is very important for us to create a competitive environment for startups, whether they founded and operating already today, or they, you know, just like someone who woodworks right now and only starting. But we need good ideas. Mm. And we need to create an ecosystem in which people can log in, interact within, and you know, public records, digital public records, or, you know, instead of having to queue for hours and hours outside of Home Affairs, you know, you might be able to, even in the most remote corners of this country, file your passport application online, and you submit it, and you only come to the office physically to give you like your fingerprints or to pick up the paperwork, mm-hmm. rather than to have to go queue forever. You know, like outside a building, not being able to earn money, you lose money. We can address a lot of inefficiencies, and we can allow people on one side to work more to make money. Applications can be created to streamline a business environment, which is less costly but creates more revenue, which again is efficiency. And all the time you don't spend, you know, in queues or waiting or being frustrated about the carbon world which you're living in. You can do stuff with your family, you can do work, or you can read a book. You know, like, technology can really ease people's lives. And I'm not even talking about automation right here. I'm just talking about that there are inefficiencies with which can be addressed just through networking better and creating networks.
I mean, yeah, technology can change lives, but I suppose the flip side to all of this technology is, and I suppose maybe we're going to deviate a little bit here, but, you know, had these Cambridge Analytica stories and Facebook and the sort of whole the whole idea of surveillance capitalism, and, you know, we are simply tools of these massive organizations that are just harvesting all kinds of data for us, about us, to create, I don't know, some kind of massive artificial intelligence machine or whatever's, or to change our behaviors in certain ways. And it's kind of, I mean, been proven that has happened now. So I'm just wondering, you know, you seem to be quite an egalitarian type, a kind of liberal capitalist or social democrat. I don't want to sort of put labels
on you.
I'm definitely
not a social democrat. I can tell that right now. I'm all about common sense.
Hmm.
Right. So for me, this is, again, like, before I can sell a product, I need people on board. And if we look at the history, why do we have these, you know, left-wing social democratic movements, parties? Why are they there? They were there because they were capable of bringing attention to their constituents' problems in parliament. But I curate my entire newsfeed online. I don't wait for the newspaper. I know what I want to know. I know what I want to research.
Mm.
And the last thing I want is that somebody asks me to adopt a certain opinion. I want to form my own opinion. And over the last 10 years, I've just seen this shift. It's become much more extreme for two reasons. That's a more increased shift from, instead of just saying, okay, those are the facts, those are the news, welcome, thank you for paying money for our newspaper. Now media outlets have more and more become opinion shapers, opinion leaders, and less want to relegate the opinion making, the opinion shaping process to the actual audience, which is extremely annoying in my eyes. The second problem we're having is when you're talking about the media and the consumption of media, there is just so much information out there, right? Like, today, if you were to open a copy of the New York Times, and I know it doesn't come out every day anymore, but you were to open the New York Times today, you have only in that New York Times more information than someone in the 1800s might have had access to across his entire lifetime. This is how much information we have on a local and global level. So we need to be very careful how we handle these things. We need to be very careful how we monitor our media. And by monitor media, I don't mean censorship or anything. I'm completely against that. But by monitoring media is I am a great proponent of holding them accountable to their reporting. And show the full picture, please. Like your audience is not stupid. Like, people I don't think are by nature stupid. Like, or at least don't think they're stupid, because that makes them angry. And nothing is worse than angry people who've got a problem, and then at the end of the day, not even a lobby to air their concerns. And then people are surprised. Ooh, there's a climate of dissent here and there. Well, are you bloody surprised? People don't get to. If people are not even allowed to express their opinions anymore, yes, people are completely entitled to their own opinion. Whether I agree with that or not, it's not my right to judge. This is called democracy. It's free speech. But nobody's entitled to their own version of facts. You know, there's facts. There's, I wouldn't say the truth, but certain things just happen. And when people then just try to bend the facts, I get a little bit confused. But I think I'm drifting off now.
Mm. But you for are me, a little bit. Now, I was trying to sort of just get your sense of where technology is taking us. I mean, you're an evangelist for technology. You talk about healthcare and education, yes, and that kind of, I suppose, the good side of technology. But I'm just trying to get some sense of your opinion on the dark side of all of this connectivity and information gathering and data mining that we are sort of the victims of, I suppose, in a way.
You gotta ask the Chinese. I forgot the name of that startup, but there's a startup now which started rolling out, which is called gate mapping or gate recognition. So every human walks. And every human's walk is more or less unique, like your fingerprint. And in China now, they started rolling out in some cities camera systems which...
That'll recognize who you are from the way you walk.
From your gait. They don't even
have... Not your facial recognition.
Not even your face, just how you walk. Is that good? I mean, I know a lot of Chinese think it's good. Otherwise, the Communist Party wouldn't get through with it. Even the almighty, Chinese Communist Party can't get away with everything, but they do, because Chinese truly believe this kind of technology will make their lives safer and the city safer. It's a culture thing. In a more African or European context, I think it's highly problematic. Our countries have been founded on the principle of freedom, democracy, citizen involvement. And if you track people's quite literally movements without having a warrant or without having
due cause,
I think it's not completely compatible with my idea what a free country should be like. So yeah, I'm not a fan. Also, I'm not a fan of extreme amounts of data mining and data collection on people. Data lies out on the streets. Every credit card transaction we operate, every time we transact and money or values or services are being exchanged. The banks have everything anyway, so that's one thing. There is already a massive ledger. Do you need to follow us in real time? I don't know. I don't think it's necessary. Yes, possibly you can curb crime, but it's a little bit like, I have the feeling, a Minority Report, where you have these three savants who predict crimes, and then you have that police unit who arrests you before you even commit the crime, but you haven't committed the crime yet. It remains that the intent is that, is that really where we want to go? Is that really where we want to go? And I think... so much data gathering in the name of preventing terrorism is a bit overkill, because I know people who are in that business and duty of protecting countries. And really, they couldn't give less of on what the, you know, last relationship struggle of that lady on the 27th floor of our apartment building is. They don't care. Mm. Profiling is a thing. Nobody talks about it. But at the end of the day, is we know the bad boys anyway. So if countries like Germany collect bulk amounts of data for the hell of it, or the Americans did the same thing with PRISM, yeah, great, you've got a lot of data, and I'm really sorry for that guy who had to check out 200,000 dick pics over the last 9 months, because it's just part of analyzing the entire data stream. It's overkill in my eyes. Mm. It's overkill, and governments should be able to trust their own citizens a little bit more. Mm. I kind of have that feeling that a lot of countries don't trust their own citizens anymore, because why would they be doing it?
Mm.
Why would they be doing it in such an extreme and such a large scale? And I'm someone who is in selling infrastructures and pitching infrastructures which are ought to make our country safer. And of course, I have no say in shaping these kind of policies. But at the end of the day, is if you do your work as a policeman or as a officer in the army or an intelligence operative, right? I don't believe you will need so much access white data, because what we also have to consider is you have to analyze all that white data. Essentially, it's not an efficient process, because AI isn't that far ahead yet where it you can sift through these kind of amounts of data. So what's my opinion? Yes, of course, gathering data on subjects which are problematic and might do damage, yes, I'm completely for it. But, you know, in a very blanketing way, suspecting your entire population of possibly doing something wrong, it's just not flying with me. It's not my vibe.
I want to just go back. You mentioned this meeting you had, sort of ministerial discussion on sort of the state of the internet or internet policy or communications, telecommunications policy.
Well, like last Saturday.
Yes. What is your sort of sense of the sort of government's thinking around communications technology in particular, and where we are from a regulatory point of view? Because there's this whole ongoing thing about the spectrum and digitization, et cetera, but we seem to be sort of falling behind a little bit if you compare, say, South Africa to countries that are always touted as being sort of at the forefront of these things, Kenya, for example, or Rwanda. What is your sense of where we are?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Like the structure of this decision making on a spectrum side is very problematic. I would say complicated. Going back to the remarks I made earlier, like dragging feet. There's also like a few issues, you know, with harnessing the white space, spectrum white space yet, in order to supplement terrestrial communications. What's my sentiment? Well, the key issue, the key challenge really is for Africa that we are a growing country. Despite whatever the analysts in the West and the North are saying, South Africa is growing. And if it's not growing economically, it is growing on a population side. Which means is more people are going to tap into existing networks, and they will all demand the same thing, connectivity. And we are very heavily reliant on undersea cables in order to get the bulk of our, the bulk of our internet capacity, which then globally gets, you know, distributed. And then the satellite market per se only makes up for a fraction of the entire bandwidth imports into South Africa. It's essentially a drop of water on a hot stone, but it's still something, right? It's still something. And where we are very different from satellite operators that are out there and lining their pockets with South African money is we are South African. We want to make a South African business. For us, it's important to keep the money we are paid to provide a service inside South Africa. which is not the case if you go, you know, to the competition, which I'm not going to name, because the money might go to, you know, Qatar or the UAE or Luxembourg, you know. And then the money is gone from the economic system. That's not good. And then on the other side is these guys, they're Ka band satellites, with the, which they usually are. Of course, there's also CNKU satellites out there. These guys are extremely expensive because they are already like on a point of the curve where they just can't start building satellites for the heck of it. They orbit their satellites to their orbital position and they just start the service to whomever can pay them. But these satellites are rarely fully, you know, booked and fully committed, which means is if a satellite is operating below break-even point, you know, that extra cost to go to the break-even point or to a profit zone gets offset against the customers actually using the satellite, which costs a fucking fortune. It is expensive. This is what you're trying to address. We can be cheap because we can be cheap. It's part of our business plan. We are an infrastructural company. We want to contribute to creating a better, more connected South Africa. And you can only do that being aware of the economic situation of the greater part of the users in this country. So we have to be cheap. We have to be affordable. That's why we're affordable. We are, if every other satellite operator is a full-service airline, we're doing the Kulula thing. Shout out to Kulula. Great service, great prices. But really, we do exactly the same thing. We connect you. We can just do it because we're so streamlined, so efficient, at a much lower price. And we can charge you, not the counter value in dollars, we can charge our local currency. So you will not have to expect price hikes every other year.
So where are you now in the project? If I can just get a sense of your kind of timelines.
Like timelines are always fun because they change. I mean, the optimal case for us would be to have a satellite in orbit by 2022-2023. We're currently considering ways to start a service, a soft launched service, a little bit earlier, but that's early days. We are very well aware that what Mzanzizat can offer to the African public and the African African governments and African businesses, it is needed. There's not a single day I talk to people who need connectivity that goes by where people go, man, this is great. Like, I would pay for a connectivity package. I would pay for this. I'd rather have a slower internet connection, but one that works 24 hours a day, rather than a fast one that conks out every 3 or 4 hours. Because suddenly, you know, like people go on it online and then you kind of crush the bandwidth. You have 60 people on one line, bang, and you have nothing. So it's about the stability of the connection also. So whether we've been talking with our service personnel in the SANDF or to people in, no-profit organizations which are working to bring connectivity to communities or just generally our app entrepreneurs, they all say this is great because also we are increasing the footprint, not just to get linked up, we're also increasing the accessible market for a lot of people. And we can grow that market. So timelines, at the latest, I hope we can start the service in 2022, 2023.
So what is the bulk of your work now then? Your people, what are they? How many people do you have in the company now?
Right now, we are actively 3 people. It used to be more, but there were a few, let's just say, management changes and life got in the way. So, you know, some people have, sometimes life deals you a really shitty hand, right? And you got to look after your family rather than look after your career. So 2-3 people I very much appreciated and which were very, very contributory to the development of Mzanzizat over the last 2 years had to go. Nothing I can do about it. So I'm kind of doing now 4 people's job right now.
And what is that essentially?
But primarily right now it is about lobbying support, not just in South Africa, but also in Southern Africa and the rest of Africa for our solution. We just, want South Africa to be our champion because, we are at home here. And South Africa is the only BRICS country that still hasn't got its own satellite. So there's a few political and economic and also you could go so far to say, you know, status-related subjects that fall into the equation, why we really want a South African solution. But we can also work with any African country. The strategy we have developed is, you know, more or less cross-applicable to anybody.
And, I mean, are you talking more to governments than to business or NGOs? Or, I mean, are you just looking for anyone who might be interested in benefiting from your solution?
It's a very fun thing that eventually ended up getting frustrating. It's the dog chasing his own tail. You know, like, say we talk to DTPS or to any other government office for that matter, and, you know, we pitch them our service. That was 2-3 years ago. We kind of are breaking out of that circle now, which is really good news. But while Zuma was still in office, essentially the entire administration was frozen. Like, nothing happened.
Was that your sense of things?
That's why we only, like, look, once Ramaphosa took the helm a year ago, as the interim president, suddenly my phone started ringing, ministers are getting swapped out. There was this sense of can-do in the air, which I haven't experienced before. So that was already great. And now Ramaphosa is our fully elected president. He's not just interim. He can drive his agenda. He can drive his policy, wherever this is going to go. But I'd rather have things moving, regardless of what direction they're moving, because at least, you know, I can anticipate where this is going to go, rather than just being like, you know, in the cryogenic box and nothing is happening. So what I'm doing right now is to lobby for support and to lobby for stakeholder buy-in for the licensing side and the landing rights of our satellite. And what I hear from organizations like CRASA, the SADC organization for telecom regulation, and the African Telecoms Union, what we do is very relevant. And a subject which increasingly, you know, becomes a really hot button topic is education. The delivery of education to rural areas and underserved schooling districts in Southern Africa. This seems to be the hugest concern of them all. Personally, I'm more from the public health side.
Right.
You know, you mentioned earlier, I'm all about free public health. To a certain degree, I think free public health is very important. A healthy country is, you know, like, has a healthy workforce. Healthy people work, and they're also less likely, you know, to develop mature onset diseases and negatively impact the balance sheets of, you know, pension funds and public funds. That's one thing. But on the other side, healthy people just feel better. If we go to the UK now, for instance, you know, the NHS, where everything is for free, increasingly now we can, you know, observe abuse of this, you know, kind of handing out antibiotics like your frozen yogurt sample at the mall kind of culture, because people say, oh, well, you know, I don't actually have to look after my health so much because, you know, if something breaks, I can just walk into the next hospital and they're going to take care of me. So, you know, the NHS is a great idea, but it has its flaws. But then you go to America and, you know, you don't have a public health insurance system and the Affordable Health Care Act. Well, let's not go into that. But you know, the question is that I don't think there's a perfect healthcare system. But I think for the basics, I think everybody should
kind
have access to, like,
yeah,
you know, to the
sort of access,
the
universal access.
Yes, you know, the WHO has like a list of the most important medicines across every single section. I think if you can get access to these specific medications on a free basis, I think you can improve the overall health of a country very quickly. So that's the other thing, yeah.
Right. And can I just, we haven't really spoken about the funding model or how are you, how is that working? Is that private equity or is it government funded?
The beauty is, You will appreciate that I can't talk too much about, you know, what's going on behind the scenes, but we're in a very privileged position because we have a parent company which is sitting in Eastern Europe. It's called Balkansat. And Balkansat has an orbital license which we as Mzansizat can directly use because we're the same company. And essentially the satellite, Balkansat realized very early on that Bulgaria is a very small country. And you know, a small country like Bulgaria will never be able to tap into like the entire bandwidth of a big satellite anyway. So if we were just as stuck with Bulgaria, we would have been like, yeah, great, we've got a satellite, but we're still not making bank because only like 20% might be used. And then South Africa kind of, you know, appeared on the radar, and we were like, yeah, okay, it's a great country, great people, great market. Yes, it's not going to be an easy one to break into, but once you're in there, you're in there, and you know, you've got this peer-reviewed credibility, and South Africa has no satellite, right? South Africa wants 5G. For 5G, you need a satellite backhaul. Like, people can argue this left, right, and center and say we have terrestrial alternatives, whatever, but in order to have proper 5G, you need a satellite backhaul if you have like these periods of extreme heavy usage. I like to compare 5G to a 50-ton truck that goes at 200 kilometers an hour. Have you ever seen that? Going a truck?
No.
Exactly. So this technology is way too high concept for the South African market. And only people who are living in, say, Cape Town or Joburg or parts of Durban will be able to afford this new technology. But I'd much rather, as a consumer, have very well-working 3G or 4G than, you know, pay through my nose for 5G. But, you know, if people want it, if it's the political will, we can provide it. But in my eyes, I'd rather provide you a good, honest 3-4G connection. And you will be happy. I will be happy. Great. Yeah. No, but in terms of financing, we own the orbital resource, which is valued in excess of 50 million euros. So, you know...
Oh, that's nice.
That's a lot of money you can bring to the table, yeah. Asset. And the project will make itself... Our preferred way of doing it is just to go through bank loans. Because, you know, banks, loans, easy. They're not sitting on the board. They give you money. They expect an interest back. Great. It's easy. I think banks... in South Africa, there's still banks, you know, which kind of like to lend money for these kind of projects, like all the merchant banks used to.
Right.
In Europe, this is much more unlikely these days. You know, banks.
It's more private equity driven than that sort of.
Yeah,
space.
Banks would like to take your money and never give it back to you in Europe. Like, that's how I feel. In South Africa, at least, you know, we give them fresh cash. They can do on the stock markets and invest with it whatever they want. A loan is a loan, so they get paid first. We don't have to deal with, you know, banks on the board because, again, the creditors, not investors. And, you know, the more conservative your financial engineering goes, the better, I guess. So us being not the most exciting business, so to say, and us being an old school solution that has been proven over and over again in other countries actually is benefiting us because we can say, look, it's been done like this before. This is how we want to do it. We're not reinventing the wheel. It's essentially, you know, a surefire deal. You know, bankers are a bit like astronauts. They live on a different planet, or they're definitely not on this planet. But they are very, very risk averse. And if you can give somebody risk averse a safe investment opportunity or a safe loaning opportunity, I can tell you they're going to jump on it.
Victor, let's leave it there. We've covered all the bases. Are you happy with that?
Yeah, I'm good. I mean, like, I'm free to. I mean, I don't even know what time it is, but
thanks for your time this afternoon, and it was great meeting you. And all the best with. I'm looking forward to the next phase of the Mzansi Sat project.
I'm also very excited. I've just had like some, you know, 2-3 very intense weeks here in Southern Africa right now. I met some very important, very good people who share the same vision and who share the same appetite for a truly African solution, where Africans, you know, can take ownership of their own infrastructure and the resources vested into them through the international community. We get some really good feedback. So I think maybe in 3 to 6 months from now, I can sit down with you again and say, hey, by the way, there's some really cool stuff happening.
Cool.
And be like, yeah, this is actually now what we can do, because it's not just, you know, it's not just a need anymore. It's now also proper political will. And we have not just the potential buy-in from people, but also the trust and the confidence in order to actually move a little bit faster. So, yeah.
That's super.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that and you got a sense of the energy and the enthusiasm he feels, Victor feels about the Mzansi Sat project, and I would have to say South Africa in general. There's no doubt he feels that satellite broadband can have a massive impact on millions of people who have no internet access today. Just finally, an apology for last week. I just had I had people lined up who just fell away and fell away, and just couldn't get a guest in. So, yeah, it's just, I suppose, sometimes the nature of things. People are busy and things crop up. Life happens, as they say. So apologies for that. I have been producing pretty much an episode a week for the last 18 months, and obviously I'm sorry that happened. Voices from SA is hosted on Audioboom. You may subscribe to Voices from SA also via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.